So at this point, we want to introduce Brother David Rice, and we're going to start with, I think, Daniel chapter 11 at this time. So, Brother David.
Thank you, Brother Bill. Daniel 11, of course, is part of it. You do as you think you need to do. It's part of a three-chapter series, and we're actually going to start in chapter 10, but the goal is to study chapter 11. You remember how many prophecies there are in the book of Daniel?
Four,
that's right. And we've studied three of them. We joined chapter 7, which is Daniel's first prophecy, with Daniel 2, which is Nebuchadnezzar's vision of the same thing. And then we studied chapter 8, which is narrowed down to, instead of four world governments, just three. And then we studied chapter 9 a little bit, the 70-week prophecy. And so now the longest prophecy of all, it has a scope of three chapters, is the most detailed one. And the brethren don't often study all of chapter 11. And the reason for that is that it's covered in volume 3, but Brother Russell says, you know, it sounds a little tinny. Is there some way you can adjust that? Brother Russell actually skips half the chapter and says, well, everybody agrees so far, and it would be tedious and detailed to go through all the specifics. Well, it may be a little tedious. We're going to be a little tedious today. We're going to try to get through those details because we've gone through them twice in our personal class studies. Our home class studies. And I found them fascinating. As a matter of fact, those verses in the early part of chapter 11 are fulfilled with such precision and such detail that if you can get through the tedium, you find that it's such a dynamic fulfillment of prophecy. There's no way Daniel was not inspired. Unless, of course, he was a fraud and wrote after the fact. And we talked about that yesterday. But even, let's suppose, in the worst-case scenario, that was true. Then when is the latest time that Daniel could have been written? Take a late time and narrow it down. When's the latest time? Was it? Yes. 1874? Okay, certainly by then. Sherelle, now let's lower it from there, Sherelle.
Well, wouldn't the latest time have been somewhere around 200 BC when the Sinaitic was translated?
You don't mean the Sinaitic.
Septuagint.
Septuagint, that's right. And we're going to see in the narrative today the very king who sponsored that translation. He comes up in a large way in Daniel chapter 11. That was in the 200s BC. So you think Daniel's part of that. Now, the critic would say, no, we can't be sure it was part of that. Maybe it was added later because you got to get to Antiochus Epiphanes by 164. Or, you know, if he's not writing after that, then he's a true prophet. But, you know, no matter what you do with that, Jeff, what do you got on this?
Well, another aspect of it is that I'm not sure I'm pronouncing the word right, because I've never heard it pronounced, I don't think, but the Qumran community.
Yes.
That they had that manuscript, the manuscript of Daniel, in their collection.
Okay.
And this collection, I mean, it would have been manuscripts from somewhere between 100 and 150, so it would have been after Antiochus Epiphanes, but not by much. And considering that the amount, it took maybe a couple hundred years before a book of scripture was considered firmly canonical.
Yeah, yeah.
And so for them to have it in that remote community implies that it was part of the Jewish community long before, you know,
yeah,
before Antiochus Epiphanes. And of course, I think you've kind of mentioned this already, but the critics of the Bible all acknowledge that the passage about Antiochus Epiphanes is so clear-cut,
yes,
that there can't be anything else. And because they don't believe in prophecy, they said, well, how could anybody know that ahead of time? So therefore, the book of Daniel must have been written after the event.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's a lot of support for that.
It's just not credible because to have somebody write a book and have it instantly recognized as somehow canonical, it just doesn't make sense. But actually, even the critics themselves have recognized now that the Aramaic in Daniel, you know, Daniel's not in Hebrew, a large part of it. A large part of it is in Aramaic, which is the normal language of Babylon where they were involved. They now concede that it's Aramaic older than 164. And this is why in the earlier chapters they now are starting to concede, yeah, okay, that was written by, you know, a Hebrew in about the time he suggests. But, you know, no matter what you want to do, what was the last prophecy we discussed yesterday? Chapter 9. Well, maybe you're right. But what's in chapter 9? 70 weeks, and that points to Jesus' death on the cross. Well, after what everybody knows, Daniel was accepted. So how could you possibly explain how Daniel, 500 years before the event, pointed the very death of the Jewish Messiah? Well, you can say, well, I don't accept you as a Jewish Messiah. Okay, you got a lot of explaining to do then. But, you know, I mean, the prophecy is reaches well beyond any disputed area. Well, now, we're going to go into the, start with the 10th chapter and get the backdrop for Daniel 11. But Daniel 11 is going to go so far beyond, it's going to bring us up to our day. And I think it's going to be very, very satisfying that this is a good prophetic book. Now, in the 10th chapter, we're just going to read a lot of this, you know, together with you and comment as we go and investigate as we go. let's start off with Estelle, would you start off with us for us in the 10th chapter, verse 1? Get a historical background for us.
You said verse 1?
Yes, please.
Okay. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a revelation was given to Daniel, who was called Belteshazzar. Its message was true, and it concerned a great war. The understanding of the message came to him in a vision.
Okay. So this happened in the third year of Cyrus. Now, that's the latest record we have, a historical record in the book of Daniel. So we know Daniel lived at least to the third year of Cyrus. Now, it says something about Belteshazzar. Who in the world is this person, Estelle? I know who Daniel is. Who's Belteshazzar? Same person. Okay, that's right. That's his Babylonian name. You know Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that we know so well? Those aren't their real names. Those are their Babylonian names. The real names are Mishael and Azariah and something, you know. They're introduced earlier that way. But we know the other names so well. But we never use Belteshazzar, you know, but that's Daniel's Babylonian name. so third year Cyrus. Now, who conquered Babylon? Okay, but I mean, who was the commander? Who was the leader? Who was the king?
Cyrus.
He was the king of Persia for 30 years before he ever conquered Babylon. I mean, he was the king of Persia for a long time. I don't put a fine point on that. I'm approximating here. So he was certainly king of Persia when they conquered Babylon. He had already conquered Astyages, his grandfather, who was the father of his mother, who was the king of the Medes. So already Cyrus, king of the Persians, was in command of the Medes and the Persians before he ever conquered Babylon. So what was the year that Babylon fell to the armies of Cyrus? Historically, what was the year? Does anybody know? It may not be as easy as possible question because we don't often use this number, but in fact, nobody thoughtfully disputes the number. So I'm going to make that clear. You know, I have a few dates that I think some other don't want to agree with me on. Not this one. This one, if you think it through, everybody will agree on. Everybody depends on this date for the fall of Babylon. What was the year that Babylon fell?
By
36 will come up. That actually is the year of this chapter, but it's not the year of the fall of Babylon. I heard it. 539 is the date that Babylon fell to the armies of Cyrus. Now, I say that's not disputed. Maybe it's not. People aren't aware. But it's any date that you hear among the brethren depends upon that date, 539. You start with that and you reason from there about other things. So that's why I'm telling you, you know, I'll let you know when things may be disputed or not. This is not disputed. This is the date, 539, period. Now, I told you yesterday I didn't want to be dogmatic, right? But I want to be firm. That's the date. But 539 B.C., of course. So when we get to, that's the first year of Cyrus. That's the accession year of Cyrus. Now, we talked about accession years, you know, a couple of days ago. But that was, it turns out, do anybody know the season of the year in which Cyrus took Babylon? Was it in the spring, the autumn, summer? Was it? Anybody know? It was in the autumn, the fall. It was in October, what we would call October. And we actually know the very day And we know the very day it fell. 16/17 of their month Tashritu. Yes, it did. How'd you know that? That's very good.
I got a lot of numbers.
Okay. Now, you know the story in the fifth chapter of Daniel, how the city fell. Who was in charge of the city when it fell? The Babylonian king. You know, the name. Now, Jackie, I'll ask you.
Belshazzar,
that's right. Now, he wasn't the real monarch. It was his father out somewhere else. But he was the regent on the throne at the time. He died that very night. And you remember the handwriting on the wall? Well, how is it that the Babylonians took the Persians took the city? How could they have taken the city when everything seems secure in there? Yes.
There was a moat around, I suppose, and they dried up, drained the water out, and then marched in.
Okay. In fact, even more than a moat, there was something even bigger. What was that, Cheryl?
Wasn't it the Euphrates River?
The Euphrates and River.
Didn't it run through the city?
It did. It did. Now, you know, the city was four square, and I draw boxes. But there's the Euphrates River that wound through it. You know, this is just my artist representation, that's all. And so you had bronze gates on either side where the water would flow under and take it. And who's the River Euphrates? How can you divert the River Euphrates? I mean, that's a major world river. But that's what Cyrus did. He had his people dig a drainage so that it would go off another way. And then the Babylonians didn't know this. And so the River Euphrates was dried up and just marched right in, took the city, just like that.
They also dumped a bunch of rocks or boulders somehow into the river as well to try and divert that.
Could be.
I think that's in Herodotus.
Okay. That's a detail I wasn't aware of. I should read more on Herodotus, see what that's all about. Now, does this experience ever come up anywhere else in Holy Prophecy? Bill?
Revelation.
The way of the kings of the east was dried up. The River Euphrates was dried up.
Isn't that the ways of the kings of the east could be prepared?
That's right. Now, from Babylon, where is Persia located? North, south, west, or east?
West.
Where is, from Babylon, where is Persia located? Which direction?
East.
Babylon is... Oh, you got the city up here. There's the River Euphrates. Oh, great. Hey, boy, this is service. I don't even have to prepare my own PowerPoints. You know, just on the spot. So over here east is the Persian kings. So it's dried up so that the kings of the east can come right through and take the city. Now, it says in the east, you know, it uses the word in the Greek, if I recall correctly, the kings of the sun rising. And when you think of the rising of the sun, who do you think of? Son of righteousness rises with healing his wings. So the Son of Righteousness is coming. He's going to conquer the old city, and he's going to dry up the River Euphrates to do that. Now, when in Revelation does Great Babylon finally fall for good? And that's it. You know, the city divides into three parts, and Great Babylon came in remembrance before God to get the wine of the wrath of his fury. Where am I quoting? Where's that coming from?
She has fallen, Revelation 17, chapter 18:4.
18:4, that's Babylon has fallen, has fallen. Now, that one, we usually say, the next expression is, therefore, come out of her, my people. So that's kind of the preliminary fall at the beginning of the harvest. But where does she actually, what I was quoting, where is that coming from?
Sixth plague.
What I was quoting was even the next part, which is
the seventh plague.
That's Armageddon. In the aftermath of Armageddon. Now, sometimes I say that the seventh plague is Armageddon. And my good brother corrects me on that. He says, no, Armageddon is only the first part of the seventh plague. Seventh plague has three parts. There's Armageddon, then the great earthquake, greater than ever was before, and then the plague of hail. Now, remember that great earthquake that never was before? You remember we talked about an earthquake the other day? That earthquake was the French Revolution. That was chapter 11, verse 13, I think it was. The tenth part of the city fell. And every island and mountain was moved out of their place. That's a pretty big earthquake. But in chapter 16, it says this was an earthquake to pass all the others. The mountains, the isles fled away and the mountains were not found, something like that. I mean, it was even more intense. That's what we're coming up to. That's the aftermath of Armageddon. So in that earthquake, the great city, Babylon, falls into three parts. What do you suppose those three parts are? Three parts that came together in Plague 6. Tell me what those three parts are.
Dragon, beast, false prophet.
That's it. You remember in Daniel, the first six chapters are all about the dragon, beast, and false prophet in that order, how they afflict the church, the first three chapters, the next three chapters, in sequence, the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, how they finally are judged and gone. That's the whole first half of the book of Daniel. So those are the three entities. So, and then after that, 100-pound hailstones. And these hailstones are like a talent each. Now, I was once in my life out in a hailstorm that became uncomfortable for me. We don't have a lot of hail in San Diego. But, you know, if you ever visited our house, you know that we're on kind of a hillside. You know, I mean, there's a mountain right in back of us. So once we started climbing it, and it was a nice, cool afternoon and a little cloud cover, and it had been raining. So we started off climbing up the mountain and got a little ways and started drizzling. That's okay. You know. Got a little farther and started raining. Well, it's okay. We kept on going and started hailing. Oh, that started hurting. And then we thought, well, we'll stick this out. And then it started lightning. Well, I said, well, okay, we're turning back. We finally got back. All the rain stopped and everything was fine. But at that time, I remember that. That was a memorable experience. That was hurting. Hurting my ears, you know, everything. The mountain had burned about a year before, so there was no protection. But these were 100-pound hailstones in Revelation. I mean, I can't imagine a more devastating, symbolic wiping away. You know, the hail removed the refuge of lies. That's devastating. 100-pound hailstones, this house would be, you know, ruined. And that's the symbology of the third part of the seventh plague. And I think that's the anarchistic aftermath. So what's Armageddon? I think that's the war. He gathers them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty in the sixth plague. And that's taking you to Armageddon, which is the battle in the Middle East, in my opinion. And then the fall of Christendom. And then after that, the anarchy that sweeps away. Now, of course, anarchy is relative. You know, even the French Revolution, you had a government. I don't think all government would be swept away. In Zechariah 14, it's clear that there are strong governments that have to be dealt with during the millennial kingdom. So, but here we are in Daniel, the 10th chapter, in the third year of Cyrus. Cyrus had done all this in his accession year. So 539 is his zero year or his accession year. So year one in the spring began 538 B.C. Year number two, 537 B.C. Year number three, 536 B.C. Now, sometimes these dates that the brethren use are not, you know, quite right. But this is the date that everybody depends on. So all you have to do is recognize that was the accession year of Cyrus and all the rest of them fall into line. Now, I could discuss more about why there's some ambiguity on these, but, you know, I don't think I'll do that right now. If you have questions, we'll handle it. But right now, I'll just pass on. But I want to emphasize 536 here because that's going to be meaningful in the number of days that Daniel has to wait for the answer to his prayer. Now, Daniel introduces this in verse 1, is saying, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed to me. And now I think that in verse 2, he's going to tell us, go back a little bit and tell us, well, the background for how this was revealed to him. I don't think it's something revealed, and then as a consequence, he prayed and fasted for more understanding. I think verse 1 is talking about what happened after 21 days when finally the angel came and gave him this understanding. That understanding is chapter 11 and chapter 12. So verse 1, I think, refers to the entire prophecy that we're going to be seeing. That's my take on it. Now let's go on. Estelle, you're doing real well. Would you read verse 2 and 3?
At that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. I ate no choice food, no meat or wine touched my lips, and I used no lotions at all until the 3 weeks were over.
3 weeks. Now, 3 weeks is how many days, Estelle? 21 days. Now, we've been noticing that in the book of Daniel, there's a day for a year connection. So I wonder if this could possibly have anything to do with a 21-year period of time. Now, Bill already talked about this a couple of days ago. So we've already introduced this. But I think that's the fact. That 21 days is meaningful, the 21-year delay to the answer to Daniel's prayer. So the question is, what was Daniel praying for? He doesn't tell us. He just tells us he was fasting and serious about something, but he doesn't really tell us. So we've got to kind of put this the thread of thought together and find out what was his problem that he was so intent for a response with. Well, let me ask you, in the first year of Cyrus, what did Cyrus do relative to the Jewish people that was beneficial for them? Randy? Yes.
He issued an edict.
He did. He issued an edict. And the edict was to rebuild a certain building, the temple. Rebuild the temple of God. That's right. Yes, Jeff.
I wrote an article on this for the Herald some time back.
Okay.
I discovered that Cyrus not only allowed the Jews to go back, but it was all the nations. And he provided money and such for all the nations to go back and build their temples. So he wasn't particularly favorable towards the Jews as such. But what the Babylonians did is they would depopulate entire areas and bring them all to Babylon. What the Persians had done was send them back to their lands, and then they taxed them. And then also, you know, took a share of their crops and such. Because if you bring everyone to one area, you're not able to have people out growing crops and other things to be able to
tax them.
Feed them and yeah. tax them. Yeah.
yeah. So. Okay, very interesting. Now, Cyrus was a noble kind of character for a ruler like this, and he was wise in this administration. And, you know, if you believed in gods, which they all did in those times, well, why not have the favor of all the gods of all your subject people? You know, treat your subject peoples well and get the benefit of all the blessings of their gods. Did it work for Cyrus? Yeah, I think so. He got the blessing of God, didn't he? In fact, God even says in Isaiah 45:1, Cyrus is mine anointed. And he favored him. He did very well. Now, if you read some of the writings about the early experiences of Cyrus, it sounds like as kings go, you know, he tried to be a fairly honorable and just person. But you remember, all these kingdoms got there where they were because of carnage. So, you know, it's all relative. You know. So he let the Jews go there. Now, by the way, if you want to read that decree, you can read a part of it in 2 Chronicles 36, part of it in Ezra chapter 1. But if you really want to get the whole thing, the most you can out of it, you've got to go to Ezra the 6th chapter. And that's where you will find the whole decree. And this is why. Because when they went back to Israel and they began to rebuild the temple, some of the enemies of Israel objected, and the temple went into abeyance for a period of time. And it wasn't until the second year of Darius, the king of the Persians that succeeded, you know, later on, we'll talk about that, that they resumed. And so what they did is the enemy said, hey, you know, they're rebuilding the temple. And the Jew says, no, look, we've got a right to do this. Cyrus said we could do that years ago. You go search the rolls in the temple, in your archives, you'll find this. So in the second year of Darius, Hystaspes, king of Persia, they did that. They went and searched the rolls to see if what the Jews are saying is right. You'll find in Ezra chapter 6, that's what it says. Darius the king made a decree, and search was made in the house of the rolls where the treasures were laid up in Babylon, Ezra 6:1. And there was found at Achmetha in the palace in the province of the Medes, there was a roll, and here was the writing of it. And now you have the whole thing laid out for you. Cyrus says what to build, the temple. He says how big to build it. He says how to build it, 3 layers of stone, layer of timber. Just the way Solomon's temple was built originally, if you go back into the record there. So it's very explicit. And so they says, oh, okay, you know, they said you could build, so I guess you can do that. So this decree is all laid out there for us. Now, when they went back the first year, did they start building the temple in 538 BC? Did they? Or did they not? What did they do in that year? Well, maybe you don't have it at the tip of your tongue, but anybody have a thought on that? Yes, Jackie?
Well, I'm going to guess, but I think they started paneling their own homes and building their own homes first.
Okay, now there was some necessity for that. Now later on, Haggai, I kind of rebuked them for that practice, but when they go right back at the beginning, you got to have a place to live. You know, you got to do something there to do that. That's reasonable. But there was something they did pretty quick as soon as they return. This is in Ezra chapter 2. No, it isn't. It's where is it now? This is Ezra chapter 3. Ezra chapter 3. And by the way, Randy, you know, Ezra writes about this, but, you know, just so you get clear in your mind about the book of Ezra, the book of Ezra has, what, 13 chapters or so? Ten chapters. You don't actually get to Ezra himself until chapter 7. All the first six chapters of Ezra are like 80 years before Ezra lived, or 80 years before Ezra returned to Israel, I should say. Say again? All right, check this out. So the 10 chapters in there and 13 in Nehemiah, is that it? I have the number 13 in my mind, so let's check it out. 13 in Nehemiah, yeah. Yeah, 10 and then 13. They're both numbers are right, different books. Yeah. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So when you read the first six chapters of Ezra, recognize you're reading something that's well before Ezra's time. It's his record of the return of Israel. But now in Ezra chapter 3, verse 1, let's see about the return of Israel. And I'm going to have you pick up with Daniel, but I'm going to use a different reader. Who's Giselle, would you read for her, or do you have a French Bible in front of you?
No.
Okay. 3:1.
When the seventh month came and the Israelites had settled in their towns, the people assembled as one man in Jerusalem.
So that's pretty good. They're coming up. Now let's read the next verse and see what they did.
Then Jeshua, son of Jozadak, and his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and his associates, began to build the altar of the God of Israel to sacrifice burnt offerings on it, in accordance with what is written in the law of Moses, the man of God.
So that sounds pretty good. They went back in the seventh month of that very year, 538, they were back in Jerusalem. So the first thing they thought of was the altar of God to start the sacrifices going. Yeah, we're going to build the temple, but that's a big project. We've got to get the altar going at least. That's a pretty noble sentiment. That's good. So when did they actually lay the foundation of the temple? That's in verse number 8. Giselle, could you read verse 8 for us?
In the second month of the second year after their arrival at the house of God in Jerusalem, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, Jeshua, son of Jozadak, and the rest of their brothers, the priests and the Levites, and all who had returned from the captivity to Jerusalem, began the work, appointing Levites 20 years of age and older to supervise the building of the house of the Lord.
Okay, so they began to found this temple in the second year. That would be the year 537. We're down here, well, there, the second year. So that's when the temple was founded. And then if you read through the rest of the narrative, you'll find out that the what we call the Samaritans says, you know, let's help. And the Jew says, you know, thanks, but no thanks. We want this done right. We want it done holy. And we know you're good people and all that, but you know, got some pagan things mixed in with your way of thinking, and thanks, but that's okay. And the Samaritans were a little offended. And so they said, well then, nobody's going to build this temple. Now that shows they're not got the right heart, right? What if you asked somebody, can I help? And they says, you know, thank you, but no. You know, you're going to plot against to make sure they can't finish the job without you. You know, that's what the Samaritans did. So they wrote back accusations and problems, and finally the temple just stopped. So here in the second year, they begin the building, and now suddenly within the next year, the temple languishes, and the work kind of stops. So there we're down to 536, the third year of Cyrus. I think that news got back to Daniel, and Daniel is in prayer because he's concerned that the progress of events in Jerusalem is not going the way it should. And I think that's why he was in prayer for 21 days. And that's the burden on his heart. Now let's just see how this pans out. Let's go back now to Daniel and the 10th chapter, and let's read verse 4. Stella, I'll ask you to pick up the thread there again. In verse 4, and I want to write down these days. Now we know it's the third year of Cyrus. We don't know what day it was, but we're going to find out because verse 4 is going to tell us some dates.
On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris,
I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen with a belt of the finest gold around his waist.
Okay. Now, this the first month of the year is called what in the Jewish thinking? Nisan. Okay. And as a matter of fact, it comes from the Babylonian word Nisanu. And so that's so I'm going to put the date here, Nisan 24. Now remember, he had been in prayer for 21 days, right? So when did he start this prayer?
Third day.
Third. He started the third. I just want to put those numbers up there because we'll see these numbers coming up now and then. So the river Hiddekel, you said it's now the river Tigris. Now there's two famous rivers, of course, in the ancient Mesopotamia. Here's the one, the Euphrates, and the Tigris was over here, and they finally joined just before they hit the Persian Gulf down here. So for some reason in this vision, he was at the river Tigris. Now yesterday I mentioned the river Ulai in Shushan, and I kind of think all these rivers have a meaning. Euphrates certainly does. It's the city on which, the river on which Great Babylon was. And I kind of think that the Tigris has a spiritual meaning and the Ulai does. But I just don't really feel that I've pierced that. I just think there's something there, yes.
Yesterday I was looking on Google and it said that the current name is the Karun River, I think it is.
For the Ulai?
For the Ulai, but that it's also called the Lesser Tigris.
Oh, really? Okay, interesting. Now that might be some symbolic point there. Okay, so that's where we are, the 24th of Nisan. So it's the beginning of the year. It's the beginning of the third year of Cyrus because his third year would have begun with Nisan. So it gives us a time frame. What do you got here? Something popping up for us to look at. There's the Euphrates. That's good. Let's see what they got. There's the Euphrates River. There's the Tigris River. They joined just before they hit the Persian Gulf. And Ulai down here. Lesser Euphrates, Lesser Tigris. And it comes down and goes into this area too. Okay, very good. Okay, so now let's, in Daniel, let's see what Daniel finds. Estelle, in the fifth verse.
I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen with a belt of the finest gold around his waist.
And keep on for a little bit.
His body was like a chrysalis, and his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude.
Okay, now there's Daniel, and that brightness off to the right is the angel he's looking at. Now, this angel, we'll find out who this is in a moment, I think. But this was an awesome sight. And verse 7, I, Daniel, saw the vision alone. The men that were with me didn't see it. There was a great quaking fell on them. They had to flee and hide themselves. Kind of reminds me of what Paul saw on the road to Damascus, yeah. Therefore, I was left alone and saw this great vision. There remained no strength in me. Yet I heard the voice of the words. When I heard the voice of the words, then I was in a deep sleep on my face to the ground. A hand touched me and set me upon my knees. And he said, Oh, Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto thee. Stand upright, for I am unto thee I am sent. And when he had spoken his word, I stood trembling. And Estelle, verse 12, why don't you pick up the reading there?
Then he continued, Do not be afraid, Daniel. Since the first day you have set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to them.
Keep going.
But the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Now I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people in the future, for the vision concerns a time yet to come.
Okay, thank you. Now, whoever this angel is, can we tell who it isn't? Give me the name of an angel that this isn't.
Michael.
That's right, because he's referring to Michael as another person. Michael came to help him. But why was the angel, whoever this is, why was he detained for 21 days? Again?
Was he in battle?
He was in conflict. Apparently he was withstood by somebody. Who withstood him for 21 days? That Michael had to come and help him so he could go on his errand.
King of Persia?
King of Persia?
Kingdom. The prince of
the prince of the kings of Persia, the chief princes. I remained there with the kings of Persia. Is that what it says? In what version?
The prince of the kingdom of Persia.
New American Standard. NIV 2. Okay, that's better than the King James then. That's better than what I got. The prince of the kingdom of Persia. So who was this person that withstood this mighty angel for 21 days? Yes?
Well, there's another reference somewhere that the kingdoms have spiritual leaders as well as earthly leaders, not in this context. So we would think that since Persia was the strongest kingdom on the earth at that time, that this was probably Satan.
Okay. So it certainly was not a human being, right? This angel would have overcome a human being like that. So it would be a spiritual power. And Michael had to come to assist. Now apparently Michael is greater in authority and power than this angel because he had to call upon a greater help to come and withstand him. Now, it says here that Michael, you know, we all think that Michael is Jesus. I think that's true. When you get to the 12th chapter, Michael's going to stand up and that's going to be Jesus, I think. We'll get to that later. So whoever was this angel, it wasn't Jesus, it wasn't Michael, but how is Jesus, Michael, described here? How is he described here in this text? In my King James, it says, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. Is that the way you would normally describe Jesus? You know, he's one of the chief princes up there. Is that what you, I know that seems odd, doesn't it? Does anybody have a different rendering that clarifies this? Young's literal translation says something different, and I like it just because it just makes more sense if this is Jesus. He says, chief, Michael, the chief of the first princes. And that tells you it's not just one of them. He's the top man. He's the, not man, but he's the archangel. He's the chief. So I think that's the point. Now, sometimes the word first and the word one are the same word in the Hebrew. So you can go either way you want, but according to the context, I think that's what it's saying. He's the chief of the first princes. Yes, Bill?
Well, just reading it out of the Amplified, it says, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And it says, then Michael, one of the chief, and then in parentheses, of the celestial, then, you know, end of parentheses, princes came to help me, for I remained there with the kings of Persia.
Okay. But again, it's one of, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that's why I kind of like Young's literal. I'd like more support for it, but I kind of like it. I'm drawn to it because of what it would mean for us. He's not one of, but he's the first of the chief princes. Yes?
There's a note in my Bible that refers us to chapter 12, verse 1. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise.
Okay, there you go. Now, that great prince, you know, the Jews think of Michael as their kind of protector angel. McClintock and Strong says that. And maybe we'll get into Michael a little bit more a little later. But, yes, go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, the scripture, I was going to use that scripture that she was saying. We used to have a discussion about this. And because many people say that that's not Michael is not Jesus.
Yeah, yeah.
But after he died, if he went back, his name still would be Michael.
Yes.
In heaven, but in a very new and different role, like Daniel 12:1. That's a different role. Now, it could have been that, you know, it's not, he hasn't died, so he might have been a prince. But after he died, he said, everything has been handed into my hand.
Yeah.
So when he went back as Michael, hey, I'm different now. I'm like king now.
Okay, very good. Now, since you're talking about Daniel 12:1, since you're talking about king, okay, let's go a little into this. And now, in Daniel 12:1, I'm going to save this for later, but we'll just jump right there. It says in Daniel 12:1, at that time shall Michael do what? Stand up. Well, that means to take authority, right? But it means more than that in Daniel, the 11th chapter. Now, let's look at Daniel 11, verse 4. Verse 3 is talking about Alexander. Verse 4, when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken. That is when he becomes king. And when you find, this is another one down here, verse 7, let's see what that says. A branch out of her root shall stand up. In other words, he'll become king. That's what it means. Now, if you go to verse 20, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes. That is, he'll come to the throne.
That's the point. And when you go down to verse 21, in his estate shall stand up a vile person. Four times this expression, stand up, is referring to the time when a new king comes to the throne. So in Daniel 12:1, then Michael will come to the throne. That's what it's saying. Well, what angel is going to come to the throne? But Jesus will. And, you know, Jesus will come to the throne and reign with, reign and put down all opposition. So I think that's what it's talking about. So Michael's got to be somebody who's going to be enthroned. And the only angel that would apply to would be Jesus. Okay. So back in Daniel, the 10th chapter, this 21 days, he was sent, but he was withstood. Now, I can't imagine that he would have been withstood by any force, even Satan himself, unless God allowed it to be so. If God sends somebody on a messenger, as a messenger on an errand, you know, if there was an obstruction, God could snap his fingers, send Michael quick, do whatever he needs to do, but nobody's going to oppose the will of God unless God permits it. So there was a permission for this delay in response to his prayer. Now, if it happens to be, that this was these 21 days of delay, were a picture of 21 years of delay, or something like that, then let's try this out. Let's go from 536, 21 years forward. The date would be 515 B.C., right? If I do this wrong, you let me know. 515. Okay. Now, let's find out what happened to the temple as time went by. Let's go to flip over to Ezra, the 6th chapter, and find out when finally this temple was completed. And it's Ezra 6:15. Whoever gets that, if you can read it for us. Glory, it looks like you're almost there.
Okay. Now, the temple was finished on the third day of the month of Adar, which was in the 6th year of the reign of King Darius.
6th year of Darius. Now, you all know there's a Darius the Mede. Don't confuse that with this person. This is not Darius the Mede. It's another Darius that came later, Darius the Staspes. Now, I'm going to see if I can remember adequately here. Cyrus ruled for 9 years. And who was the successor of Cyrus? Does anybody happen to know? It was his son. You know, Cambyses, okay. And he ruled for 8 years, as I recall. And then there was somebody else came briefly in there.
Pseudo-Samaritan?
Yeah. Now, I'm going to put this name, Bardia. That's the way he's actually known in some of the tablets. You know, they didn't write English, but I mean, that's the way it's transliterated. And he ruled for a couple of months. Some people think he was the brother of Cambyses, Smerdis, and some people say, no, he was a false, you know, claimant. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. He reigned a couple of months. He didn't reign years. And he was succeeded by Darius. Darius? Okay, now to distinguish him from any number of other Dariuses, because some others came along and there was Darius and me before him, we call him Darius the son of Hystaspes. Or sometimes just Darius Hystaspes. And so if you ever read about Darius Hystaspes, that's his father, and that just tells you which Darius he was. He ruled for like 36 years. And then, just to finish it out, to give some context, Xerxes came next. Anybody know how long he reigned?
21.
Okay, good. Very good. And then another person came along. That was Artaxerxes. Okay. And how long did he reign? Anybody know?
41.
That's right, 41. And then there were some more. You know, it kept on going before Alexander finally came and conquered them all. So in this series, let's find out how many years transpired between 536 and 515. That's 21 years. But let's see what happened in 515 if we're at the right spot. From the third year to the ninth year would be 6 years. I'll just write down here, 6 years. And then we go through the 8 years of Cambyses. And then in what year of Darius was the temple finally finished? Sixth year. So you've gone, third to ninth would be six, to the eighth here, to the sixth Sixth. Okay, so that would be, well, that looks like 12, 20 years. Okay, now let's see, what month was it finished? Adar. Adar. Oh, so, okay, that's the point. Adar. Now, here's the Adar is the 12th month, not the first month. So it actually takes you in our calendar into the next spring. And so that takes you one more year, 21 into 515. Okay, so it does work. It's just this whole thing started in Nisan, but it ended at the end of the year, so a year has gone by. So here's the point. It was 21 years, in fact, between Daniel's prayer and the time when the temple was complete in 515 B.C. Now, you can look at any historical record you want and see if this jibes with the dates they give in any modern reference works. It will. So 515 is when the temple was completed. There was a 21-year delay. I think there's 3 weeks, 21 years, 21 days of delay in response to his prayer was emblematic of that 21-year pause. Well, I think there's even something deeper for us, Brother Jeff.
That was my question. Is there any meaning that this all started 10 days after the 14th of Nisan?
Maybe. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't have thought on that.
And there's 3 days then, too.
Yeah. We're going to see those numbers maybe somewhere else in a little bit. Let me ask you, when the temple was finished, what was the date? Somebody read it. Gloria, you read it. What was the date?
The third day of the month of Adar.
Third. So, okay. So you've got the three involved there with respect to the temple. Now let's go, let's not go too much farther on that. Let's just ask this question. What does the temple represent? If you go to the New Testament and you ask the question, what does the temple of God represent? What would you say? What would the apostles say?
The church.
The church. Okay, now Peter is famous for saying that we are living stones in the temple of God. Now, when Solomon, let's go back to Solomon's temple, when Solomon began to build his temple, what year of his reign did he begin that temple? Anybody recall? Well, let me ask you this question. How many years did it take him to build the temple? You recall that? Okay, it turned out to be 7 years, and he began to build in his fourth year. I think this is a picture that Jesus, after his 3.5-year ministry, he was anointed to Jordan. So in his fourth year at Pentecost, he began to construct the spiritual temple. It took 7 years. There's the seven stages of the church. And when they finally inaugurated that temple, they kept the Feast of Tabernacles about that time. Where does the Feast of Tabernacles belong in God's plan? What is it? The kingdom. So this 7 years takes you the construction of the spiritual temple, the gospel age, and then you're ready for the kingdom. So I think the temple pictures the whole gospel age. How long is the gospel age? Well, you know, I could give an opinion on that. You all know I have an opinion. But let me just put it in round figures and ask you this. How many centuries total do you think the gospel age consumes?
21.
Parts of 21 centuries. That's right. So I knew this thing about 21 years, you know, and I actually presented that some years ago in a lesson before some brethren. It was Sister Diane Lucas that came up to me afterward and says, well, you know, the gospel age is parts of 21 centuries. I said, oh, my goodness, of course, you know, that makes sense. And so this great introduction to this vision that's going to take us to the millennial kingdom, the raising of the dead in chapter 12, well, that kind of all makes sense to me now. This 21-year day delay, 21 years for the temple, 21 centuries for the real temple, oh, it just all makes sense now. Now, of course, nobody could know this until we're already at the end of the age and we know it's about 21 centuries. By the way, if the church had been complete in 1914, you know, it wouldn't have worked. You know, so even the delay, you know, it shows that this now makes sense. We couldn't know that, we couldn't make this application. Diane Lucas could not have thought of this until we lived so far into it that we could see, yeah, it is parts of 21 centuries. So now we can see little tidbits that we couldn't see before. But I think that's the point. Now, Daniel represents who? Did we say in our first session?
Church.
The church. And so this is a whole gospel age picture, and Daniel is for 21 centuries, you know, in type. There's the church that's praying, fasting, trying to be strict with themselves, you know, and of Christian discipline until finally
they get the full fruition of the answer to their prayers. Somebody had their hand up. Paul? Paul, and then...
And, you know, you said God would permit this period of time, and that's exactly, you know, half of the permission of evil was for the construction of the temple, was for the, you know, the building of the church.
Yeah.
And that was a special type of evil in which, you know, they would be persecuted for what they believe.
Very good. Thank you. Yes.
Did I misunderstand you? Did you say it took 7 years to rebuild the temple?
7 years to build the temple.
Okay.
That the original Solomon's temple. I know here we're okay. Talking about Zerubbabel's temple. I know we are. Here it's 21 instead of 7.
But because in Haggai chapter 1, verse 14, Zerubbabel and Joshua are encouraged to rebuild the temple. Verses 14 and 15.
Yeah. No,
that's the second year of Darius. Haggai 1, 14 and 15.
Haggai 1, 14. Let's go there. Let's go there. I kind of wanted to go into there a little bit anyway. Haggai 1, 14 and 15. Go ahead.
Right. I don't have the verse up in front of me.
Now, who is this Darius you're talking about?
Yeah, which Darius? Is it the first one or second one?
Okay. Darius Hystaspes. It's this man here. And you remember the temple had been, you know, just kind of it went into abeyance. And you know, this even pictures a spiritual temple. Jesus laid the foundation. The apostles began working on it. The apostles died. Things began to decline. And it kind of went into abeyance for a while. And then it was resumed later on. Now, it's resumed. Two prophets said, let's get going on this. Who are the two prophets that were instrumental in resuming the work?
Haggai and Zechariah.
And finally, they finished it. Who actually was the builder of that thing that really was Zerubbabel. Who was Zerubbabel a picture of that builds this spiritual temple?
Jesus Christ.
I could say more about that in the genealogies. You know, in Matthew and in Mark and in Luke, you have two genealogies of Jesus. One starts and goes through David and then comes through Solomon. The other goes through David and goes through Nathan, right? And they come together. And then they split apart and go to Joseph and to Mary. You know where they come together?
Zerubbabel.
That's right. The one.
We have a discourse on that.
Yeah, the Zerubbabel. That's the picture of our Lord Jesus. That's very interesting. Go ahead.
And then the other passage is Ezra 6:15.
Okay, let's read. Well, 6:15 is what tells us.
And that's the sixth year of Darius. Darius.
Oh, same Darius. Okay. What happened was the second year of Darius, Haggai and Zechariah says we got to get back on track here. And they finally finished it by the sixth year of Darius. So Haggai, let me make a note of this. Haggai and Zechariah are the two prophets that said, let's start resuming the work on this building. Now, which of these was older and which was younger? Do you happen to know? Which was?
I think Haggai was older.
Haggai was older. In fact, if we go to Zechariah, and notice this. There's something about a young man here. That's it. Zechariah 2, verse 4. Zechariah 2, 4. Haggai and Zechariah are contemporaries. One's older than the other. And Zechariah 2, 4, let's see what that says. Jackie, do you have that? This is the angel speaking about Zechariah. Go ahead.
And said unto him, run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls for the multitude of men and cattle therein.
Okay. Speak to this young man. That young man was Zechariah. So that's what leads us to believe Haggai was the older. Zechariah was the younger of the two. But there's a tandem here involved with the re-establishment of the work. Zerubbabel's the builder, but they're just encouraging them to go. Go ahead.
Not only is there a tandem, if you compare the timing of each of the prophecies, between the two?
Yes.
Haggai chapter 1 is the...
Well, let's get this down now. Haggai chapter 1, go ahead.
Is the first day of the sixth month.
Okay.
Of the second year of Darius. So first day
month.
Of the sixth month. And that's the second year of Darius.
Uh-huh.
And then Haggai 1:14
uh-huh.
is the second year of Darius, 24th day of the sixth month.
Okay.
That's the first prophecy. The second prophecy The second year of Darius, 21st of the seventh month.
Which day?
Second year of Darius, 21st day of the seventh month.
Okay, go ahead.
That's Haggai 2. And then Zechariah is second year of Darius, eighth month.
What day?
I didn't write it down. Zechariah 1:1, whatever that says.
What does that say? Anybody?
Doesn't say.
Doesn't say. Okay, all right.
And then Prophecy 3, Haggai 2, 10 to 14, is the 24th of the ninth month.
That's
still second year of Darius. These are all happening within the same year.
Give me that date again.
Second year of Darius, 24th of the ninth month.
Okay, anything else?
Prophecy 4, second year of Darius, 24th of the ninth month. That's Haggai 2, 20 to 22.
Okay.
And then Zechariah has 11th month, 24th day. That's in Zechariah 1, 7.
Okay.
And then Zechariah 7, 1 is fourth year of Darius, ninth month, fourth day.
Fourth day. Okay.
And then Ezra has 6 year of Darius, month of Adar, third day temple completed.
Third day. Okay. That's interesting. Now, the only reason I brought these down is just because in Daniel, he's praying and he finally gets a response on the 24th day. So he started his prayer on the third day. Did we write? Yeah, 3 and 24. And now you've got 3, 24, 24, 24, 24. There's a 21, the space between them. I just find that these numbers are interesting. They're not random. There's a propensity to be linked together. So I think all of these are about the rebuilding of the temple. Daniel's 21 days and on the 24th day and starting on the third day is all, I think, about the temple. It kind of links it together topically. That's all. It's a little bit loose, but, you know, there's the same numbers repeated. Now, I'll just give you a thought here. I think these two people that resumed, Haggai and Zechariah, I just have a personal opinion that this is talking about two notable Christian leaders that began to resume the work of building the temple. And that was William Miller. And then the young man, who's that? Somebody younger than him. And that was Brother Russell. George Church. Yeah, I think it was Brother Russell. That's my own thinking on this point. Okay, that's a tangent here. Let's go back now to the book of Daniel. Okay, I think we pretty much exhausted the 10th chapter. Is there anything else you want to ask about this? We haven't found out who this angel is. We're going to find that out in a moment. But in verse 21, let's read 20 and 21. We didn't read those two yet. 20 and 21. In fact, Estelle, are you with us? Chapter 10, 20 and 21.
So he said, "Do you know why I have come to you? Soon I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go, the prince of Greece will come. But first, I will tell you what is written in the book of truth. No one supports me against them except Michael, your prince."
Okay. Now, I think this means that symbolically that Grecia is going to be the next kingdom. Why would he, early in the reign of Persia, talk about the prince of Grecia who's going to come? 150 years later, Greece was the next empire. I think this is a little precursor to Daniel that that's what's going to happen. Now, Daniel already knew from the 8th chapter, which was earlier than this, that by name, Greece would supplant Persia. So I think probably Daniel's putting this together himself and saying, oh, okay, I think I get the point here. But now, nobody maintains with me except Michael, your prince. Now, we got to figure out who this angel is. Has another angel appeared in the book of Daniel that we can name?
Gabriel.
Where did he appear? That is right. That's the only other angel I know of who has a name that we know. We know Gabriel and we know Michael. That's it. Now, the Jews have a tradition where they have Uriel and all a few other. Well, I don't know where they get them, but that's all I know. 921. Read that.
While I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation.
Okay, now in the ninth chapter, what's the prophecy going to be about? 70-week prophecy is going to take you to where? To who? To Jesus. So it's interesting to me that if Michael had been sent on this mission to give Daniel the testimony about the coming of Jesus, he might have, well, I don't know, he's talking about himself, you know. It just seemed more appropriate to me that he sent another angel to talk about the coming that Michael would represent. Now, when finally Jesus was to be born, God sent an angel to tell Mary she was going to have a child. What angel did he choose? Gabriel. So it seems appropriate to me for Gabriel to be the angel who gives a prophecy that's relevant to this as well. So you got the just the two involved here. But you might ask, if Michael's superior, why didn't Michael go on this mission? Well, I think it's because it was about the birth of Michael, and that wouldn't have been, you know, quite appropriate. Or it just seems more appropriate this way. So I think this is Gabriel. Now, it says that about the time of the evening oblation, what's that about? Ben, you talked about that. The burnt offering that you read about the other day, that's the evening burnt offering. The burnt offering is about Jesus. And in the ninth chapter, it's all about the coming of Jesus to make reconciliation for iniquity. So that time is appropriate. It's about the evening sacrifice, about the ransom sacrifice our Lord would give. So that's meaningful. Now, in the 11th chapter of Daniel, verse 1, maybe I can have Estelle read that, because that is kind of identifying who the angel is in chapter 11, I think. Now, wait, before I go there, though, is there another mention of Michael, of Gabriel, anywhere in Daniel? Is it just chapter 9?
There's one more in 8:16.
Can you read that for us?
I heard a voice call out over the Ulai River. Gabriel, explain to him the meaning of what he saw.
So in the 8th chapter, you have Gabriel by name. In the 9th chapter, you have Gabriel by name. Is that right? Okay. Am I right? Both verses, you have Gabriel by name.
Yes.
Okay, so
He's given an order.
There's somebody directing him. So he's not the superior. Somebody else is directing him. Oh, that's a, you know, I had overlooked that. That's a good point. Now, when did chapter 9 occur historically? In what year of what king? David? Oh, okay. It should.
The first year of the son of
the head. Use the microphones.
Yeah. Okay. First year of.
First year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus.
Okay. Now this
of the Medes.
This is Darius the Mede. This is Darius the Mede. Now I'll talk about him maybe a little bit, but that's Darius the Mede. Now I want to point that out. It was the first year of Darius the Mede when this occurred, when Gabriel was involved in giving us a message to Daniel. Now let's read chapter 11, verse 1, if Estelle would do that for us, when she's finished inscribing her notes.
And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him.
Okay, so that's referring back to the first year of Darius the Mede. I think what it's telling us is that this angel that's now talking to Daniel is the same angel that was active in the first year of Darius the Mede. And that, by name, was Gabriel. I think this is Gabriel. However, I admit to a certain uncertainty about the meaning of chapter 11, verse 1. If I was writing it, I wouldn't have said it this way. I would have said, you know, I'm the same person that was in the first year of Darius the Mede when I was cooperating with Michael there also. But what it says is, when I stood to strengthen and confirm him, right? It's almost like I was giving him support. And I don't quite get the point here, to be honest. But all I can say is, it seems to connect Gabriel, this angel, with the angel that was active in the first year of Darius the Mede. Now, some of you can pierce the meaning of chapter 11, verse 1 better. I'm all ears, you know, if you have any opinion on that. But at least it connects this Gabriel, I think, with the same person. Dave, do you have anything on that? Okay. All right. Well, Randy? Okay. Well, Bill, did you ever? Okay. Well, if you ever think about 11:1, Estelle, sometime, and you know, you can't sleep at night, read that again and figure that out for me, won't you? Give me a thought on that. Okay. So now, in Randy.
Just a question. You said that not
earlier on. You said that not all of the chapter is commented on. Does this
sort of a shortfall in some et cetera.
You mean in the Bible student's comments?
Right.
In the 11th chapter. Oh, I see. This is part of the 11th chapter. Yeah, you're right. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think probably there isn't too much on this, but there he actually does comment on the first four verses.
Right.
But then the interval after that, he doesn't comment for several verses.
But it doesn't disturb the theme. The theme is extractable from the chapter.
That's right. That's right. Very much so, yeah. Okay, then let's go into the actual prophecy. And this is the 11th chapter now. Now we're going to get into the thick of the 11th chapter, which is the most complex prophecy of the book of Daniel. Period. I mean, that's it. But the first few verses are not all that hard. They're pretty straightforward. So we're going to ease into this pretty gently. So now we're in Daniel 11, verse 2. And Gabriel is going to start speaking to Daniel and telling him what's going to happen from here on. So let's start with 11:2. And let's see. Let's find another reader now. Gabriella, would you take up the thread here? 11:2. Now, remember where you are. You're in the third year of Cyrus here. Third year of Cyrus, yeah. So now that'll help us figure out the next king's coming up.
Okay. And it's 11:2?
Yes.
And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And when he is waxed strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece.
Okay. Now, if we're already in the reign of Cyrus, and there's going to be three more kings after him, which kings are those that are the three that are referred to in this passage? Jackie?
Darius, Xerxes, and Artaxerxes.
Remember, we're starting here. Now, if he said one more king is coming, which one would he be referring to? Cambyses. So that's the one. And then there would be the two. He didn't reign very long, but he was on the throne. I mean, he's got to count. And there's number three. And then, what does it say about the fourth one? There's the fourth one.
He's richer than the rest.
He what? Richer than the rest of them. And he's going to do something. Stir up his whole realm against which country? Against Greece. And this is famous in history. It's famous in history that Xerxes was, in fact, richer than his predecessors, and that he decided he's going to vindicate the effort of his father, Darius, by going against Greece and finishing them off. And he took an army that Herodotus says numbered 5 million, and some modern historians say, that's just too big to be credible. I don't know, one way or the other. But it was a huge army, probably the biggest army that had been assembled up to that time in history, and he went against Greece, and Greece didn't have a chance. But somehow, they weathered the storm, and they came out of it. And so it was. He didn't accomplish his purpose. Jeff?
Wasn't that the story of the 300 involved with that?
Yes, it was. The Battle of Marathon. And there was Battle of Salome. There are a few crucial battles that the Persians should have won, but they didn't. And that's what tilted the balance of power so that Greece could form, and now they've got battle-hardened troops, and now they can, in another century later, they can actually take the advance back the other way and be the next empire. If Persia had wiped them out or really thoroughly defeated them, Greece would not have been the next empire. Wouldn't have happened. Yes?
The fourth king there, Darius?
Yeah.
Is that the same one?
First king is Xerxes.
Well, right, I'm with you. On Darius?
Yes.
Is that the same one as Cotomanus?
No.
It's not.
Cotomanus is way down the list here. There was a Darius Nothus and then a Darius Cotomanus. Way down the list. And he's the one that Alexander vanquished. Darius Cotomanus. Now, I know why you're asking, but go ahead. Say more.
No, you tell me.
Well, it's because... I'll tell you what you're saying. Okay. It's because one view of this says, well, maybe the fourth king that he's talking about is talking about the king that lost to Alexander. But to do that, you have to just jump and say, well, maybe he's the fourth main king, something like that.
But it really doesn't work. And so I know where you're getting the suggestion. I just think the suggestion is misplaced. Probably picked up from another Christian writer that it found its way into the third volume. But a number of, if you listen closely to what, you know, thoughtful brethren have said through the years, Brother Shalhoub, I think, had this right also. You actually count four kings from Cyrus, you get to Xerxes. And he actually notably did exactly what that verse says. He was very wealthy. He stirred up the whole realm against Greece. And it was an abortive conquest that didn't work. But it was a milestone of history, because if that had turned the other way, it would have turned history altogether different. Then Greece wouldn't have been next. I don't know what that would have done to Rome. Who knows? Everything would be different. Parallel universe, something else. But this is the way it did happen. And so it's a milestone of history to note that that was an abortive campaign and conquest. That's what Daniel 11 is going to do. It's going to touch the highlights of significant events that were turning points or unique events and really show us that this is the prophecy. Okay, any further comments up to this point? Okay, then let's go a little farther. The next part still is kind of easy. And that's verse... Oh, I should say more here about Xerxes. If you turn to... You know who this man is? Does he appear anywhere else in the Bible? Who is that by another name that we know?
Isn't he Ahasuerus?
Ahasuerus in which book?
Esther.
And Esther, that's right. He's the king in the book of Esther. And if you look at Esther... the first few verses. What does it say is going on in the book of Esther? Let's see. Esther. King Xerxes or Ahasuerus ruled. Does your Bible actually say Xerxes?
Yeah.
Your okay, because the same guy, so they just give him the name. Everybody knows him by more. So.
One of the translations says.
Okay. And in the third year of his reign, verse 3, is anybody turned there now? Gracia, are you in Esther?
Yeah.
Could you read Esther 1, verse 3? And some microphone is coming for you.
Esther 1, 3. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence.
And one more.
And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days. 180 days.
180 days? That's like half a year. Boy, talk about a big feast, a big party, a gathering. What was this all about? Well, if you had matched up with what's going on historically, this was his preparation for the invasion of Greece. That's why he's getting all the nobles together, feasting them, getting all the wealth together, and preparing the battlements and ready for the invasion. Now, what happens in the book of Esther on this occasion? Well, he's a little, you know, have too much to drink, and he calls out for somebody to come and show herself. What was that? Who was that?
Vashti.
And she refused. Now, I know, sounds like, you know, she, you know, this was not the days of women's lib, right? So I know Vashti was put upon a little bit, but you got to remember who Vashti really was. She was not the queen of the empire. She was not his wife. And if you look at my McClintock and Strong's, I think it'll give comments that make this clear. Vashti was the queen of the harem. She had one job, to be beautiful. That was it, one qualification. Now, who replaced Vashti in that post? Esther? Now, when they searched for Esther, did they check her pedigree and figure out what your noble family was and all that? You say no. How do you know? Did they do any research on this? Find out what she was, who her background was? Hey, Carol? No.
Mordecai?
Okay, they didn't even know that. Maybe they did. I don't know, but.
They didn't.
They didn't know she was Jewish.
They didn't even know she was Jewish. Yeah, they had no idea. So they didn't do much background checking here, right? What was her qualification for the post that she filled? That's it. That's it. Now, I think Esther is a picture of the church. And what is the qualification we have for the post we want to fill? Inner beauty. That's the king's daughter, all glorious within. That's it. Doesn't matter what your pedigree is, how pretty are you? In the terms of character attraction. That's the point. That's the point. And so I think she's a beautiful picture of the church. But notice, this is the third year of this king when he deposed Vashti. And now he says, okay, find out a replacement. Send through all the young ladies of the kingdom. Let's find the one that's the most beautiful. That's it. One qualification. Now let's see when Esther goes into the presence of the king. This is chapter 2 of Esther, verse 16. Gracia, can you read that for us?
So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign.
7th year? When did they start looking for this woman? What year? 3rd year. Well, 4 years later? What was going on for 4 years that delayed this? I mean, I think if I was the king, I'd say, quick, bring me a young lady, you know? Well, what was going on was he wasn't there. He was out trying to conquer Greece. That's the historical connection. Esther fits right into that historical connection of what Daniel's talking about. He went out on his campaign to get Greece, and as McClintock and Strong says, he came back disappointed from the conquest and consoled himself with the pleasures of the harem. So that's the interval. That's the 4-year interval that we're missing here in Esther. That's why. Now, when Esther goes into the presence of the king, I think that's a picture of the completion of the church at the end of the age in the, what does it say? Which year? The 7th year of his reign? I think that's the 7th year of the reign of our Lord Jesus, 7th stage of the church. That's when the church goes beyond the veil into the presence of the king. There's a lovely picture there about that. But I just want to connect that Esther and Daniel chapter 11 are connected. Esther gives you the historical episode that's going on that Daniel is predicting. So now let's go back to Daniel 11. And Bill, you tell me what our time schedule is, but I can make a few more verses here.
Yeah, go ahead. I'll just find out.
Okay. And let's look at verse 3 and 4. 3 and 4 are you know, straightforward. That won't be a difficulty. Now, let's see. Who can read for us 3 and 4? Have you got it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority, as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, not according to his authority, which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides them.
Okay, that's verse 4. So in verse 3, a mighty king shall stand up and rule according to his dominion. Who do you think that mighty king is that's referred to in this scripture?
Alexander.
And rule according to his will, because he's in charge, he's in control. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken. When he comes to the throne and is finally successful, he's conquered the world. What happened, Jeff?
Zoned out for a minute.
Okay, that's right. When Alexander was the height of his power, he conquered everything.
I got you now.
Returned to Babylon.
He died. Supposedly got drunk and he died one night.
He died. Now, more than just being drunk and died. You know, when I heard that story, he got drunk and died. But other people said he probably had malaria or something like that. So he might have had, you know, it might have been more than just. More than just drinking too much. But whatever it was, he died. How old was he when he died? 33. Now, do you remember what we said yesterday about Zechariah 9:9? Thy king cometh lowly unto thee, having peace, bringing peace and all that. And that's a picture of our Lord Jesus. Well, I do kind of wonder if his death at 33 kind of parallels that. I don't know. But anyway, I just noticed that in the back of my mind. But he's a young man. That's the point. A young man in his prime. And he just conquered the world. You know, there's a story about him that he wept because there was no other place to conquer. Well, it's not quite right. He had plans. He had plans to go all across North Africa and establish Grecian cities and then on the other side of the Mediterranean and really take over the whole thing, you know, like Rome was going to do later. But that wouldn't have fit the prophecy, of course. And he died in his prime, so he couldn't fulfill what his dreams were to do. But Rome did that later. Rome would do that same thing, yes.
Version I know is that when they were in India and they were starting to conquer their way through India and his men were finally homesick and they were tired of it and they just told him we're not going any further.
That's it. This is it. I mean, it's far enough, you know. And so what do we got here? A map of India. Oh, yeah, this is his conquest of Alexander. Okay, just on the spot, just like that. So he left here. He went. Now, here's where Zechariah picks up. He comes down here to Tyre, and then he goes down here, and it goes. Well, this map is, I can't, the coastal area is not big enough to show, but he went down to the Philistines, and then he went back up to Jerusalem. They went over here and had a conflict with Persia. Then he went over here, I guess, all this area, and conquered all the way to India. All the way to India. He could have gone farther if, you know, he wanted to, but his men says that. Let's go home. Enough is enough. So then he came all the way back, came back to Babylon, and that's where he died, at Babylon. And I've often wondered, what an interesting city to die at. There must be some maybe meaning to that. But he died at Babylon, 33 years old, just about the time when most young men are hitting their stride. He's finished his course, and he's ready to go. So it's split up into four pieces. That's what it says. If you divide it to the four winds of heaven, is that what it says there? Yeah, divided to the four winds of heaven. We read about that yesterday. And the four horns that came up for the big horn, we read about that. So we won't go into detail there, unless another map pops up. But so that's pretty easy. That's pretty easy part of Daniel, the 11th chapter. Now when you get to verse 5, now things start getting more complex. Now if you do have that map you used yesterday, of the four parts of the Grecian Empire, Lysimachus and all that stuff, if you have that, we'll look at. Oh, there we go. Okay. There's the four parts of the Grecian Empire. Now, Israel is right here. So with respect to Israel, there's the two empires that are going to impact it. The Seleucid Empire, which went all the way to India, like where Alexander was, and the Ptolemaic Empire of Egypt. So when we talk now, starting with verse 5, about the king of the north and the king of the south, just these two kings, that's the only ones who are going to interplay with Israel. We're talking about the Seleucid Empire in the north and the southern Egypt Empire in the south. Those are the two kingdoms we're going to be reading about ad infinitum for the next many verses in chapter 11. It's going to get very detailed. It's be very precise. To me, it's very engaging. And the prophet, you can't doubt that this is the meaning. So much so that there was a pagan man who didn't believe in this prophecy. Way back when, his name was Porphyry, if I'm saying that correct. And he actually explained this whole prophecy and how it fits, because he knew the history. And then he concluded, since he didn't believe in it, that it must have been written after the fact. You see, that's where that seed thought comes from. But in fact, Daniel was a prophet that wrote when he said he was, and it was bona fide prophecy. So we're going to be getting into all the thick of that. We can start, I guess. Bill, I don't know what time
is. Who's not here, so we're going to have to, we can prolong this.
Okay,
we're
okay.
Going to take a break.
No, I'll just keep going, if okay. That's all right. If everybody's okay with that. Huh? Okay. Then let's look at verse 5. That starts getting us into it. Let's see, the new reader. Marvy, can you read that for us? 11, verse 5.
The king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power.
Okay. So, now here I have to use a few notes because there's a lot of detail here. But I think I should put on the board at this point a list of the rulers that we're going to be talking about from hereafter. So I'm going to erase this list. These are the Persian rulers. We're kind of finished with that. Alexander now has already taken over after a whole list of Persian rulers. And
how many rulers were there after the ones you have listed?
Okay, actually, I can tell you that.
how many years did Darius put up
that? You know, I could go back and give you a little more detail about some of this. Let me rewrite this. This was Cyrus.
Pull that up on Beauties of the Truth too, that one there.
Yeah.
And then we could just look at it on the
well, actually,
he wants to write on the
if you got if you can find on Faith Builders Fellowship, yeah, you could call this right up. You could do that possibly. It's a PDF file. Can you just display a PDF? Okay. Then go to 2043ad.com. And oh, you know, wait, I can just do that. You don't have this plugged in. I could just show that. Yeah. That would be the easiest way to do it.
Hey, Dave, see if Shana's up there.
No.
Oh, okay.
These four.
This is what I want here.
Yep.
Okay. There you go. There's the list of all the kings of Persia. There's Cyrus for 9 years, Cambyses for 8 years. That's Smerdis, alleged brother of Cambyses. I called him Bardia over there on that list. That's the way he appears in the tablets. Darius, the Hastaspes, Xerxes, that's the Ahasuerus of Esther. Artaxerxes, he's the one that sent Nehemiah back, and Ezra back, by the way. Ezra and Nehemiah lived in that reign of him. Sogdianus, half-brother of Artaxerxes for just a few months. Darius II, Nothus, 19 years. Artaxerxes II for 46 years. Artaxerxes III for 21 years. Artaxerxes IV for 2 years. Another Darius comes in. There's Cotamanus for 6 years. He's the great-grandson of one of the other guys. And then Darius III Cotamanus, he's really the last real king of Persia. He was killed by this Artaxerxes V, killed Darius, but he killed Darius because Darius had already been kind of overtaken by Alexander and was in retreat. So it was really Alexander was in charge by that time. So usually we think of the last emperor as Darius III Cotamanus, and you'll see that reference in Volume 3. That's what you were talking about earlier. So these are all the rulers of the Persian Empire. I guess this guy, technically fit in there for a little bit, but Alexander was already kind of in power by that time. So that's the list of the kings of Persia. Now, all of those are skipped over. All of these are skipped over, except this guy, Darius II, Nothus. There is a record of him in the Bible. That's the latest historical record we have in the Old Testament. And it's in the book of Nehemiah. I'll just turn there briefly. It's Nehemiah, the 12th chapter. Let's see. See if I've got this right. Verse 22. Nehemiah 12:22. Who can read that for us? Who's there? Nehemiah 12:22. Bill?
Nehemiah 12:22. The Levites in the days of Elishabab. And then I got it. Oh, my goodness, all these names here.
Joiada
and Johanan,
uh-huh.
And Jadadu.
Jadua. Uh-huh.
Jadua.
Okay.
Recorded chief of the fathers, also the priests to the reign of Darius the Persian.
Okay. So you got a record of the priests up to the reign of Darius the Persian. That Darius the Persian, if I'm remembering this correct, is this one, Darius the II Nothus. So I think that's the right one. Now, I suppose it could have been this one, but I'm pretty sure my memory is telling me when we researched it was this one. But that Jadua, and I'm going from vague memory here. I wasn't prepared for this. Jadua, I think he was the high priest at the time Alexander came. And remember we mentioned yesterday that Josephus says that the high priest went out to meet Alexander and he showed him the prophecies of Daniel about Alexander? I think that was Jadua. So that maybe that's the last figure historically that we have in our canonical Old Testament. That must have been added to the record because that was after the days of Nehemiah. Somebody else has to add that note a little bit later. So
that would make him the last Darius because look at the years.
You mean this Darius?
Yeah. That Darius might be referring to
the last one.
Last one, because if Jadua was still there when...
I understand where you're going. I understand, but I don't think so.
He would have to have been like 90-some years old.
Well,
the Bible dictionaries, most of them say he was the one from Alexander the Great.
Jadua. Jadua. Okay, we got that Jadua. Now, what do they say about the Darius of this verse? Darius of Nehemiah 12:22. Okay. Joyce, I know what you're saying, but I don't think that's the way it works. I think there's
Darius
some...
Codamanus.
They say that?
Yeah, or Barnes does.
Barnes does. Darius the Persian. Anybody else say something different?
Clark says Darius Nothus.
Darius Nothus. That's the sources that I read. I'll just have to leave that a void here. Joyce, I understand the point you're making. I understand. But I thought that it was just talking about two different lines and two different times. But anyway, certainly if this Jadua is the one that appeared before Alexander, that's got to be the last historical record. And that would have appeared right around in this time somewhere. Okay, so now let's see. We're going to go back to... I wanted to give you a list of all of the rulers of the Grecians that are going to be commented on. And we can do that right here. Let's see. That doesn't get bigger, right? This is Faith Builders Fellowship, and it's on the website. Are you? Okay. It's let's see which one it is. I'll flip that right back. It's January, February 2008. January, February 2008. Oh, that's great. Okay. Let's see. Now it's... Yeah, there we go. Okay, thank you. This is, I love this tech area. Thank you for your help. Now, here's all the rulers. Now, you notice these are six generations of rulers that are going to be discussed in this chapter. And over here we have six generations of rulers for the kingdom of Syria. So this is the kingdom of Egypt, the Ptolemies in the south. This is the kingdom of Syria. Now, these are the two kingdoms that lasted. Lysimachus and Cassander, one consumed the other. I forget which way it was. Do you remember? Either Cassander defeated Cassander.
Thrace was the one that disappeared.
Disappeared early?
Yeah.
Then that means Cassander would have taken over Lysimachus. Okay, Cassander from Macedonia took over Lysimachus. And then after that, the Seleucid Empire overtook that one, if I have my understanding correct. So you're left basically with two strong kingdoms. That's it. Now, there was a Macedonian kingdom still, even later on in the time of Philip. So maybe it wasn't totally taken over. But the two strong kingdoms that remained were the Seleucid Empire and the Egyptian Empire of the Ptolemies. So here they are. Ptolemy. Now, what year did Alexander die in? It's on the board, actually. It's up here, I mean. 323, that's when he died. So that's when Ptolemy took the richest kingdom of all. That was the kingdom of Egypt. And he started in 323. He actually didn't call himself king for a dozen years or so. It was very political, very diplomatic. You know, that would be stressing the position that he had. But as time went by and he secured more and more power and authority, and he did adopt the word king. But if you start with 323 when Alexander died, he had a total reign of 38 years. Long reign. Seleucus turns out to have been a helper for Ptolemy. Now that's what verse 5 of Daniel is saying. Now, it wasn't the case that Alexander died, the four generals or commanders took four pieces and they went their own way. That just isn't what happened. In fact, can I switch from this to the other quickly and go back and forth?
Yeah, there's a button next to the power called source. Just
okay.
Press that once whenever you want to.
Okay.
It'll come up in a
second. Okay. Now, here you see the division of the Grecian Empire into four pieces. It just didn't happen just like that when Alexander died and they went their four ways. There was another man that came in that tried to hold things together. His name was Antigonus. I think he was the one-eyed man. I guess he lost his eye in a battle somewhere. And he lived to a ripe old age, and he kept trying to bring Alexander's empire back together. He just couldn't quite handle it. But because of that, Seleucus actually fled to Ptolemy for protection and for help because of this problem with Antigonus. He didn't have his own empire right away. So he became a supporter of Ptolemy. Seleucus did. Now, you notice what verse 5 says of Daniel 11. The king of the south shall be strong. Boy, he was. That was the richest part of the kingdom. No question about that. He was a strong ruler. That was Ptolemy. And one of his princes shall be strong above him. Well, now that's a comparison. Because the Seleucus who fled to Ptolemy was a helper of Ptolemy. He was one of his princes, one of his supporters. But then later, when he had the chance, he went back and took control of this kingdom after the Antigonus threat was over. And that's why, if we flip back again, I'll just hit that.
Yeah.
I have just hit this button.
Antigonus was 81 when he died.
81, yeah, ripe old age. So when you flip back, you see that Syria started in 312. That was some years after Ptolemy started in 323. And in this year, 312, that begins what they call the Seleucid era. And that's a long-running era that goes into the Roman times, you know. And if you look in Josephus, you'll find all kinds of, and in the Book of Maccabees, all kinds of records dated by the Seleucid Empire. And that all comes from the name of this man Seleucus. Now, it wasn't animosity that caused the split between Ptolemy and Seleucus. He was a friend of his, and Ptolemy helped him secure his kingdom. But when he did, now we go back to show the kingdom, you see how much bigger this kingdom is even than him. So he actually became stronger above his own mentor. Now, that's the kind of detail that's, you know, life is just that way. It has a lot of strange things that occur. You wouldn't have supposed that his underling is going to end up being stronger than his own mentor. But it did. And these are the oddities of life that are recorded in the prophecy that tell us how specific the foreknowledge of God is. This is really remarkable. And all the way through, we're going to see the same thing repeated. And his dominion will be a great dominion. That was a great dominion. Now, you see here that Ptolemy had control of the area that we would call Israel. And he kind of always considered, the Ptolemies did, that really belongs to them. Israel is really belongs to them. But as time goes by, the Seleucid Empire is going to conquer this area from time to time. So the people that are in the middle are the Israelites. And that's why this is such important history with respect to Israel. The king of the north and the king of the south. They didn't bother them. But these two were battling back and forth. And mostly it belonged to Ptolemy. Okay, now, well, I don't know how much farther to go. Okay, let's go to verse 6.
We can take a break, but there's, you know, we're just going to, there's nothing, no lunch.
Okay, all right. Then if it's okay with you, we'll go on to verse 6. And who could read verse 6 for us? Marvie, do you have it?
Yeah. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and his power will not last. In those days, she will be handed over together with her royal escort and her father and the one who supported her.
Okay, that was all of verse 6. That's a long verse. And this is talking about a marriage alliance between the two kingdoms. Now, there are two marriage alliances that occurred between these two kingdoms of Egypt and Syria. And they're both recorded in the book of Daniel, the 11th chapter. This is the first one. The next one is going to be way down here with Antiochus Magnus. We'll get to that later on and halfway through the chapter. This is the first one. And by this time, Ptolemy Philadelphus is now the king. There have been two wars between these two powers. The first one lasted for about 3 years. The next one lasted for 6 or 7 years, something like that. All these details are in the article in this Faith Builders Fellowship, by the way. And so as a consequence of these wars, the two powers really were becoming a little exhausted. And especially in the Seleucid Empire, and now we're down to the time of Antiochus Theus, he had other problems brewing in the empire, and it was helpful to him to have an alliance with Egypt and not have this constant war. And it was helpful for Egypt, too. It was just bleeding their troops and their wealth. So there was an agreement. Now, if you see, these are relatively short reigns. This is relatively long reign. So it was Ptolemy Philadelphus who made a marriage alliance together with Antiochus Theus. Now, Ptolemy Philadelphus, we have talked about already this morning. He did something very notable. Sherelle referred to it, even though he didn't refer to the name. What was that, Jeff?
He's thought to be the person who sponsored the Septuagint version of the Bible.
That's right. So you see, he was very helpful to the Jewish people. Now, you remember on that map, it was Ptolemy, the Egypt, that really had the kind of the dominion over the land of Israel. So he was kind of their mentor in that respect, and he was noble in this respect. He helped the Jews translate their Bible into the existing language of the day, which is Greek. So there's the Septuagint version. That's the version that Paul quotes. That's the version he relied on. You're going to write in Greek, you might as well quote the Greek version of Scripture. Yes?
What was his motivation to do that?
You know, I think he was just a benefactor that was trying to, like Cyrus, you know, help the various people in his area. Now, there was a good group of Jewish people in Alexandria. Now, that comes up later when one of the Ptolemies begins to persecute them. So he had a contingent right in his own country of Jewish people. And therefore, it was, you know, you might as well try to do what you can for this contingent. And it was a pretty good thing that he did. He got together 70 scholars, or maybe there were fewer or less, but that's why it's called Septuagint. It's about 70. I mean, there's kind of a myth about this, you know. The myth was, I call it a myth because it just seems unbelievable. The myth was that each one of the 70 scholars, was it they independently translated, or at least teams of them did independently, didn't compare notes, anything. And when it was all finished, it matched word for word. Oh, well, I don't think that's credible. Because as it is, the Septuagint is not really a very good translation. It adds things to the text, you know, it changes things, it changes numbers. You know what the Septuagint does to the numbers before the flood? It adds 100 years to each one of the generations, tries to extend out their history. Now, if you're translating faithfully, are you going to do that? Or you got a political motive for stretching your history, you see? So the Septuagint is not the source that I would look to for a reliable translation. Now, you go ahead.
And the Hebrew text, the earliest Hebrew text, the scribes were instructed to test whether they had done a good job by the numerical value of each chapter. Is that not correct?
In the Hebrews.
Yeah,
copying
Hebrew
to Hebrew.
It could have been sullied by the translators.
Yeah, Septuagint was much more loose, let's put it that way. Sister Marge. Let's get that microphone. Yeah.
If you follow out the chronology of the Septuagint, instead of leading to the millennial age, it leads you to the papal millennium.
Well, interesting. Okay, that's an interesting thought. I got to pursue that and see some more about that. That's interesting. So the Septuagint is not my choice of translation. But if you're going to write a Greek letter, you're going to quote the Greek translation. That's what Paul does. And that does lead to some interesting, you know, questions. Sometimes he quotes the scripture from the Septuagint. That's quite different than the Hebrew. But there it is. He's quoted it. So now what do you do with it? So this leaves, I think, I've noticed just observationally that a lot of commentators in England tend to favor the Septuagint even over the Hebrew, because I think it goes back to the fact that the apostles quoted it, so it must be better. But over in America, most of the commentators do not follow that line of thought. They tend to say, no, the Hebrew is the original. That's more pristine. And I certainly think that that's true, too. So I would go by Hebrew where there's a question. But Ptolemy Philadelphus was very prominent in that point. So very helpful. But it was him in his waning years that said, we got to make a compact, and that was Antiochus Theus. Now that, you know what that word means? This is not a humble person.
God.
Yeah, God. Yeah, it's kind of. So anyway, that's the person that made a marriage alliance. So let's look at verse 6. In the end of the years, after two wars between them, they got to make a marriage alliance. The king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. So it's the daughter of Ptolemy Philadelphus that's going to go marry Antiochus Theus. Now, if you've done a little research on this, and there's so many details, I don't, you know, expect you to have all these in. But if you know, do you know the name of the daughter, Ptolemy Philadelphus' daughter, that went to be married to the king of Syria? Berenice. And there's even a constellation that refers to her name, Berenice of Coma or something like that. And so that's the daughter. Now, there was a small problem with this marriage alliance. And that is, Antiochus Theus already had a wife. Okay, now this isn't going to work out too well, right? So what was her name? The name of the wife of Antiochus Theus. Laodicea or something like that. Now, we know that name because he loved her so much that he actually created a city and named the city after her. And that city is one we know real well, Laodicea, because we're of the, you know, symbolically from the Laodicean church. So that's one of the churches of Asia Minor. So that was part of the Seleucid Empire at that time. So imagine if you're Laodicea, and you know that this marriage alliance is brewing. Are you happy or not so happy? Not so happy. You already have a son, and that son's name is Callinicus. You already have a son by the king. When your husband goes, your son is going to be the next king. But not anymore. Not if you have a marriage alliance with another person and another wife comes in and another child is going to be born. Who do you think is going to be king? It's going to be that one. So she's not very happy about this. Jeff, what did you have on this?
It says that on the death of Ptolemy, Antiochus took back Laodicea.
Oh, you're way ahead of us. Okay, what are you reading, by the way?
I have Cook's Commentary and Woodward.
Okay, good. So those are independent sources. Okay. So in the narrative here in verse 6, it says, but she, this new wife, will not retain the power of the arm. I think that means of her husband. Neither shall he, her husband, stand, nor his arm. But they shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. Now, if you look in the margin for he that begat her, maybe, I don't know what your version say. Does your version say he that begat her? That would be a father. Or does it say something else?
The one who sired her.
It does?
The one who sired her.
Okay. But in my margin, it says, or whom she brought forth. And I think that's the point. I think it's her son that's being talked about. So let me put on the board here. I'm going to erase some of this stuff and put on the board here the actors in this drama. Now, remember, it's Ptolemy Philadelphus that is the father of Berenice. And you can erase this now. I never did really get back to Darius the Mede. Maybe we'll do that some other time. It's not really part of the study today. So we have Ptolemy Philadelphus. I'll put Philadelphus here. Phil. And his daughter was Berenice. And then her son. I don't remember her son's name right now. I'll just put her son. He would be the next king of the Seleucid Empire.
Doesn't get a name.
It does not? Okay. And then we have Antiochus Theus here. And then his wife was Laodicea. And her son was Callinicus. And this whole thing is going to fall apart. Because remember I said that this king, Theus, loved his wife so much that he created a city and named it after her? Well, guess what happened as time went by? He loved her still. And so he actually puts aside Berenice and takes his wife Laodicea back again. Now, at this point, Jeff read that Ptolemy Philadelphus died. Didn't you say that in your comment? And I think that that's the sequence. Now, that's not, different commentators say it differently, but I think that's what happened. I think Philadelphus died, and then Theus said, you know, I'm going to take my old wife back. I love her more. And so Berenice is now in trouble. She's got a son, and she's on the outs, and politically, to have her around anymore is not very helpful. And Laodicea says, I'm not going to risk my flirtatious husband's affections again. I'm going to get rid of him and see that my son is put on the throne. So she has him poisoned, and he dies. Boy, talk about palace intrigue here. So Callinicus becomes the next king. And that's the next king you see here, Seleucus Callinicus. He reigns for 21 years. So this isn't working out too good, you know. But now Laodicea, what do you think she thinks of Berenice? She'd like to get rid of her. And so, say again?
She chases.
Go ahead, tell me more about this.
Whoa. I copied and pasted some quotations out of the history book.
Okay.
So, this is from John Pentland Mahaffey, The Empire of Alexander the Great. It says, the discarded queen and her party managed to entice Antiochus to visit them at Sardis. There he was poisoned, and forthwith the young Egyptian queen was pursued through Antioch to her retreat at Daphne and murdered.
Okay. So she finally was murdered. Now, there's two different accounts. The next verse tells, well, I should go through verse 6 again and tell you what I think each part means. Verse 6, at the end of the years they shall join, there's the marriage alliance. The king's daughter, that would be Berenice, shall come to the king of the north, that would be Theus, make an agreement, well, marriage alliance, she'll marry him. But she will not retain the power of the arm. I think that means her father, who was the strength that supported her, Ptolemy Philadelphus, shall not retain that because he's going to die. I mean, look, he's 38 years, he's kind of old. So he's going to die, and then she's going to be in trouble. She'll not retain the power of the arm that supported her. Neither shall Theus stand, nor his arm, I think, Laodicea, because I think the whole thing is just breaking apart here. And then, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her. She will be given up, and they that brought her. And also, according to my margin, the one that she brought forth, her son is going to be killed as well. Laodicea doesn't want that son, who's a possible contender for the throne, laying around. So he's going to be killed. And he that strengthened her in these times, well, the person that would strengthen her would be Philadelphus, and he was off the scene. I think that's what it's talking about. Sometimes some of these particular individuals might be interpreted differently. But I think that's the point. Now, I will say, if you really want to get all the specifics down on paper and understand it, we've given our opinion on this in writing in great detail. It's in these faith builders. They're on the internet. You can find them if you want them. Just search for it. Google something. You'll find it. But now in verse 7, let's go down to verse 7. Out of a branch of her roots, now, who is the root of Berenice? Who is the root of Berenice? Where did she come from? She came from Philadelphus. So out of her roots will come forth another person. Well, who would that person be considered in relationship to Berenice? Another sibling that came from the same roots, but he's a man. Who's that going to be, do you think? Her brother. Her brother is going to come to the throne, and that would be Ptolemy Eugertes. Eugertes means benefactor, and it's because he's going to end up benefacting his people of Egypt in a great way. You'll see how this unfolds in a minute. But it says he's going to rise up. That would be Eugertes. And one of the versions that I have read says, because Philadelphus died first, and then Theus decided to reject Berenice and go back to his original wife, Philadelphus is off the scene. So who's the king now? Eugertes. And now he hears about all of this going on. And he knows that his sister is in jeopardy. So what's he going to do? Try to save his sister. He knows how things are going to turn out. Now other people say, no, his sister was killed and he went in there to exact vengeance. I think it's more credible that he went to save his sister. And that is what a Roman historian, Justinus, says. Porphyry says something different. I think he's not accurate.
That's why this history book has both.
He has both. Okay. But when I went through, Justinus is an actual historian. Porphyry is a person commenting on the prophecy, and he doesn't even believe the prophecy. I think he's more likely to be wrong. Justinus says he went to save his sister before she died, but he was too late. He couldn't save her. Now he's got vengeance on his mind. So it says in verse 7, a branch out of her roots, that is Eugerites, shall stand up. That means to become king in his estate, which shall come with an army and enter into the fortress of the king of the north and shall deal against them and prevail. Now let's go back to that map. Oh, I can do that. So he comes riding up to her rescue, and there's a city of Seleucia around here somewhere. That's the main fortress city of that area, and that's what he takes, the fortress city of that kingdom, Seleucia, humbly named after Seleucus. You know, that's the way they did. You know how many Alexandrias there were scattered over the Middle East, wherever Alexander went? So that's just the way they did. So he comes riding to rescue. It's too late. She dies anyway. But he just takes over much of the kingdom. He's extremely victorious. And now in verse 8, he also shall carry captive into Egypt their gods with their princes and their precious vessels of silver and gold. So he was really victorious. He took a lot of that land. He could have even taken the whole empire, but he didn't. But he took a lot. And those gods that he took back, what is a god? How can you take a god back? The idol. And the idol is made of gold, silver, precious things. So they're valuable. You know how many idols he took back? This is remarkable. Did you see this in the writing?
Somewhere, but
like 2,500. This is a lot of wealth he's taken back. Well, where did those gods come from? They came from Egypt originally. And guess who it was? The son of Cyrus, Cambyses, who had invaded originally, taken those as booty, and now hundreds of years later, they're taking them back again. This is one of the really oddities of history, but it's marked here. It's just, you know, truth is stranger than fiction sometimes, but it marks all these really kind of odd things. But he took all these gods back with him, back into Egypt. Now, the last part of verse 8 is different in different translations. And I'd like somebody else to read. Jeff?
Farrar says that it was 4,000 talents of gold, many jewels, 40,000 talents of silver. But he also will carry back with him to Egypt 2,500 molten images.
There's the gods.
Idolatrous vessels, which 280 years before, Cambyses carried away from Egypt.
280 years before? Yeah, okay. So there's a lot of stuff, a lot of booty he took back.
And
And 40 talents of gold. What's a talent? They say it's 100 pounds. So, boy, how much an ounce is gold today? You know, this is a pretty fabulous sum of money. So it's a lot of booty he took. Now, in verse 8, and I think with the last part of verse 8, then we are going to stop. You know, you can take a break, do whatever you want. Okay. But I'm afraid the facts are just coming too thick. You know, we got to take a little break here. Overload. Yeah. Now you see why Brother Russell says we'll just skip this part. You know, that's what he does. So everybody agrees. You wanted the details, go find a commentary. So that's it. But it's impressive when you realize this was all prophecy, all these details. And how could, I mean, once you understand the history, you see that was fulfilled. Very specific. But the last part of verse 8, who was reading for us? Was that Marvie? What version are you reading?
NIV.
Let's read verse 8 again. And it's the second half of the verse that I'm interested in.
Chapter 8?
Yes, verse 8.
Verse 8. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold, and carry them off to Egypt. For some years he will leave the king of the north alone.
Okay, there you go. For some years he will leave the king of the north alone. He could have followed that up and maybe have taken the whole empire and had an extended empire. But he heard some concerns about back home. Maybe there's a little rebellion or something. So he said, no, let's shortcut this. Let's go back, make sure I'm stable here. And for some years, there was no conflict between them. Now, in the King James it says, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. But I don't think that's what it means. It is true that he outlived the king of the north. It is true. But I don't think that's what it means. I think it means he's going to he's going to desist from further animosity. So Eugerites took over a lot of the kingdom. He even left troops up there in Seleucia, so he's kind of got a presence up there. And he says, that's good enough. I'll return with all this booty. So this is now, let's see, Antiochus Theus, that's who he defeated. And, Antiochus Theus is the one who was poisoned by his wife. So Seleucus Callinicus now is in power. Now, in verse, I said we'd stop with that. But
okay, so it's going to be another half an hour or so, but we could take a 10, 15 minute break and then
then let me go just a little farther.
Okay.
To verse 9. Okay, because okay. Verse 9 is connected. Marvie, I think if you're reading the NIV, let's read verse 9 in the NIV. Now, 8 and 9 are the two verses in the entire chapter.
Or do we all want to stand up and sing a hymn or something?
Well, what do you say? You want to do that?
Let's do that.
Okay, all right.